This is The Source. I'm Jennifer Pemberton in the studio with Ross Chambliss for this last episode of The Source.
Being that this is the wrap-up show, we shouldn't end before we talk about maybe our thoughts on what was the most important story, perhaps, of this past year.
I mean, there were so many important stories and a lot of things happened this year. I mean, the year of water, 2015 was the year of water, and that was a Utah State University designation, it was basically a marketing campaign, but it was a way to sort of think about and focus on the research that was happening. And so by running this show for a whole year, it just made us, you know, think about the entire year as it pertains to water and water stories and the news that was happening. And so it was an interesting sort of way to chart the calendar and to think about the seasons passing. The story that got under my skin the most, I think, and that I sort of tracked all year, I think it was in our second episode, we talked about the Great Salt Lake. So this would have been February or March, so it was early in the year. It was sort of winter, almost a year ago. And I'd heard that the Great Salt Lake was shrinking. And the Great Salt Lake goes through these cycles every year. Obviously, the water runs, melts out of the mountains and runs into the lake, and it fills up, and then it evaporates over the summer, and it sort of goes through the cycle every year. But even with that cycle, the trend is downwards. We're losing water out of the Great Salt Lake. And I didn't sort of think about that as being a really big deal. And I think I was like a lot of people in that the Great Salt Lake, we all know it's salty. You know, you can't drink the water. It smells bad. People think of it as kind of a dump, and historically they used it as a dump. And it is where the sewage, granted it's treated, but the wastewater from Salt Lake City ends up in the Great Salt Lake, and it's kind of an unpleasant place to be. And so I never really thought about it as a place you could go and hang out, and that it was ecologically rich or interesting or anything. And so I started reading about Terminal Lake. So the Great Salt Lake is the end of the line. It's salty because it doesn't have an outlet and it evaporates, and what's left behind is a lot of minerals and a lot of just straight up salt. And I was reading about other salt lakes because they're really unique. And salt lakes, terminal lakes throughout the world, are all threatened and they are all drying up because we're using the water before it gets there. It's not, I mean, part of it is about climate change and part of it is about things heating up and evaporating. But another big part of it is that we're using that water for irrigation, for drinking, for everything before it gets there. And why wouldn't you? The idea for a long time was any drop of water that makes it to the Great Salt Lake is a waste. Like, what you know, once it hits the Salt Lake, you can't drink it, you can't irrigate with it, you can't do anything with it. That's still a management perspective that's in play.
Wow.
So I ended up talking to a guy named Wayne Wurzbach, who is in the Watershed Sciences Department at Utah State University, and he was talking about this lake in Iran called Lake Urmia. And Lake Urmia is really interesting because it's a twin to the Great Salt Lake. It looks exactly like the Great Salt Lake. They are like the same distance across. It has a causeway that it's a driving causeway, not a railroad causeway, but it's a bridge basically that cuts across the middle of the lake and separates the halves, which is what's going on in the Great Salt Lake. So it's an interesting sort of experiment that's already in play. And some of the researchers from Iran, from Lake Urmia, called researchers in Utah and were like, hey, our lake's drying up. How come your lake looks so good? And the researchers in Utah, who are, of course, like, our lake is very threatened and we're very worried about this downward trend in the Great Salt Lake, realized, I guess, in some ways, how much worse it could be. And there were several factors of sort of why it was worse in Iran than it was here. There are a lot more people depending on it. It's closer to the equator, so it's warmer and they have more evaporation, things like that. But I didn't realize how precious the Great Salt Lake was. And so I've been watching it eagerly this whole year. I actually go to the U.S. Geological website and check the lake gauge every once in a while. And and just in December of 2015, so sort of as a weird recap itself of the end of the year of water, the Great Salt Lake in the north arm of the Great Salt Lake got to its lowest level in history, like in recorded history, which is really, really troubling. And it was a sort of blip, you know, in the news cycles. But for me, having learned this about the lake and watching this play out all year, I will never think about the Great Salt Lake the same way again.
to do a follow-up story on the lake level, so I called Corey Angeroth with the U.S. Geological Survey as soon as I heard the news about the historic low.
Well, we've been watching it. We knew that the north arm of Great Salt Lake was on its way down.
Angeroth is a hydrologist with the U.S. Geological Survey, and he's in charge of monitoring the lake and river levels across the state.
The USGS has operated a lake level gauge on the north arm of Great Salt Lake since April of 1966. We've been operating lake gauges on Great Salt Lake in general since September of 1875.
The Great Salt Lake is essentially two bodies of water right now, separated by the Union Pacific Railroad tracks that span the lake on a raised causeway. The big rivers that feed the lake, the Bear, the Weber, and the Jordan, they all flow into the lake to the south of that causeway.
When the causeway was put in 1959, it had two culverts in it that allowed for, well, originally, it's my understanding that they were put in for navigational purposes so that boats could travel between the north arm and south arm, and that allowed the two levels of the lake to be more equal and also to allow for mixing of the waters. So in 1963, when the record low was recorded in the south arm, the two arms of the lake were more equal at that time than they are now.
The culverts were closed a few years ago. They were in bad shape, kind of closing in on themselves already as they started crumbling.
They'd always had a pathway for water to flow from the south arm to the north arm. But now that the culverts and the causeway have been closed, the causeway is really just kind of acting like a dam.
The water in the larger south arm of the lake is about 2 feet higher right now, which sounds nice, but it's hovering within a foot of its own historic low. There are plans to punch a new hole through the causeway this year to allow water to flow back and forth again. But depending on when that happens, it could mean that the whole lake drops down below its low record.
If we get an above-average snowpack, that would be great for the lake. If we get a below-average snowpack, then there is the potential that we could be seeing a record low.
The record low in the north arm of the lake is a reflection of how little precipitation we've gotten in the past year, and a shrinking lake means that more lake bed is exposed to the elements. It also means that some of the islands in the lake are no longer islands. You could actually walk to Antelope Island from the lakeshore right now. That's bad news for the birds that nest on these usually isolated beaches. But scientists like Corey Angeroth are looking on the bright side of this hydrologic anomaly.
This is really kind of a big experiment going on where we've got the north arm and south arm separated from each other. And you know, when this new breach is opened up later on this year, it'll be very interesting, and we're hoping to be able to get out there and do some more monitoring to see how the lake responds to this change from being basically two separate lakes right now to going back to being a more connected lake.
I always think it's interesting how scientists think. What some people see as catastrophe, they see as unprecedented experimentation opportunities. Kind of puts it into perspective, I guess. I've been kind of doing my own non-scientific monitoring of the Great Salt Lake this year, and for me, the story about the shrinking lake was an all-encompassing one. It was the story that really stuck with me, and it made me think differently about water. As a metaphor, for a stand-in, for our relationship with our watershed here in Utah, I don't know, it really kind of changed me.
Wow. And certainly it's a story to be continued, right?
Yeah.
Reaching the lowest level ever. What does that mean? We're going to have to just kind of wait and find out.
Yeah. How low will it go?
Yeah. Wow. Well, for me, I felt like the top story of 2015, the top water story for 2015 was one that we kind of touched on in a few places, but not directly with a story, but it did get a lot of media attention overall. And that was the legislative water audit that came out kind of towards the end of the summer or early fall. This was a legislative audit of the Division of Water Resources and basically where they were getting their water numbers from. And it basically found that the division was not using reliable data that they found that there were significant inaccuracies of the division's data. It questioned the reliability of the division's baseline water use study. And this was the study that projected Utah's future water needs that was based on what they said was old data from 1992 to 1999, for example, and which may not have given an accurate representation of Utah's future water needs. So it was a big deal because it says the division needs to go back to the drawing board and figure out where do we stand? How much water are we using as a state? But it is also a big deal because that really impacts the projected water use, and are we necessarily going to have to spend more money, billions of dollars, on water development projects in the future? And specifically, the Bear River and Lake Powell Pipeline. The Bear River Dam proposal, which it seems is a little further off than the Lake Powell Pipeline. The Lake Powell Pipeline proposal is said to be needed a lot sooner, you know, like early 2020, 2022 perhaps, is when supposedly St. George is going to run out of water. Bear River is perhaps a decade or so down the line, but it's certainly something that would affect all of us living here on the Wasatch Front as far as where we get our water. And certainly how it would impact the Great Salt Lake and its water levels. Again, just a story that's not going to go away. It's going to continue and perhaps be more of an important story in the years to come. So we'll see.
A lot of people that we talked to this year in various water management roles, you know, they always say that, you know, one of the best sources of new water is conservation. I mean, we can't just keep finding. You know, it's not like gold. It's not like we're going to discover, you know, the mother load of water. We know where all the water is. And the only place that we're going to get more water is if we're wiser about how we use our water. And that's, you know, I learned about that through the dam episode and the drought episode and the episode about the Great Salt Lake. I mean, it got mentioned so many times.
It's a recurring theme.
And that was the big thing with the audit. It's like the state's trying to figure out how much water we're going to need and how much money we're going to need to spend to get it. And it's not an easy task to figure that out. And there are a lot of great minds sort of on the job, and there are a lot of great people policing the people who are on that job too. So that is an ongoing story. That is what's happening in the state right now. And just because the year of water is over and just because the source is over doesn't mean that we're not going to keep our eye on it, and it doesn't mean that it's going away anytime soon.
It makes me sad, you know, to hear that the source is over.
It's definitely bittersweet. Oh.
It is. But it was a fun year. It was a good year.
It sure was.
Yeah.
All right. Well, okay. For The Source, I'm Jennifer Pemberton.
And I'm Ross Chambliss.
The Source is produced at the studios of Utah Public Radio with major support from iUtah. I'm Jennifer Pemberton. I produced all 12 episodes of The Source in the pleasant company of Ross Chambliss and Ryan Cunningham in Salt Lake City. There would have certainly not been a program without those two, and I'm eternally grateful for their involvement, their willingness, and their contributions. The program also received some help from the staff at Utah Public Radio, especially Carrie Bringhurst, Tom Williams, and Bennett Purser, under the direction of General Manager Peg Arnold. Megan Simper wrote and performed our theme song, and I don't think I've ever mentioned this before, but she wrote the song for this show. I asked for something watery and science-y, not too sad, but not too upbeat, something kind of folky, kind of flowy. And somehow she translated that commission into what you hear each month at the beginning of the show. It's a gift, really, and I'm thankful for it. And of course, thank you for caring about water in our state. All 12 episodes of The Source are up on upr.org if you want to revisit them. I'm Jennifer Pemberton. Thank you for listening.